Hello, everybody. This is the Gingerbread Man, and I would like to welcome you to my home. So thank you for being here, and let's get on into it. So the two main principles that I stand upon are unconditional love and this idea of creative living. And in order to enunciate what I mean by creative living, I want to first consider what choice is and how and what we do when we make choices. And to do that, I want to share with you a quote from one of my favorite philosophers, the late Simone de Beauvoir. And quote, "From that formless night, we can draw no justifications of our acts. It condemns them with the same indifference. Wiping out today's errors and defeats, it will also wipe out its triumphs. It can be chaos or death, as well as paradise. Perhaps men will one day return to barbarism. Perhaps one day the earth will no longer be anything but an icy planet. In this perspective, all moments are lost in the indistinctness of nothingness and being. Man ought not entrust the care of his salvation to this uncertain and foreign future. It is up to him to assure it with his own existence. This existence is conceivable, as we have said, only as an affirmation of the future, but of a human future, a finite future." Now, this got me thinking because pretty consistently I feel like I warn against putting too much pressure on fortune telling, on this effortful prescribing of what we think we're going to do next. Because obviously we can't tell the future. We can't tell what's going to happen tomorrow. We can plan for it. We can do our best to try to pave the road in that direction. But ultimately, all we really have is this ever-present moment right here. Constantly, we're making choices. Constantly, we're making new ideas, and we're stepping in different directions. Last week, I decided to use the analogy of like a spider's web, where in the middle of the spider's web is the present moment, branching out into every single fractal dimension of futureness. Now, Simone here warns against putting too much stock in this future that does not exist yet. In existentialism, Sartre says that we are constantly casting ourselves off into existence, hence the existentialism. So for him, he saw this as a negation because reality as it is exists outside of this life, this isness. So in order to make this isness, in order to make our identity, we have to negate the reality of what is. And for Sartre and for Simone, they say that we are doing this just a million times per second. We are unceasingly casting ourselves off into that supposed negativity. But that negativity is the freedom of life. So I've been thinking a lot about her words today, especially when it comes to this creative act that is living. And if I could do anything with this outlet, I would like to inspire any and everybody out there to consider what it is they want to do with themselves, what they want to do with their lives, and know that you are free. No matter how oppressed you might think you are, you have the freedom to choose anything. And I find that kind of crazy. And I find it creative. Now, love is a tricky spot because too often we find conditioned responses for why we want to like something. You know, and this makes me think of like elementary school when you have the crush and everybody's like, oh, do you like that person or do you just like that person? Like, I don't think it really matters the relationship in general. What really matters is how, no matter what we do, we are intrinsically part of everything else. Now, this connection to everything, I find that to be magnetic. I find it to be like if you have two water droplets really close together, they sort of like suck each other up and they become one water droplet. This idea of unity which is the reality in itself that Sartre is depicting in existence and the being for itself. Now, what does it take to stop the separation that is intrinsically part of identity? So we've cast ourselves off, we've created this negativity, not in like, oh, negative, but we've cast ourselves away from reality in order to make ourselves, right? Now, that separation is necessary in order to have the I, in order to have the identity. But what does it take to reverse that separation and to go back towards seeing the connection? Now, for me, that's kind of how I see this definition of love, because the interaction between the bee and the flower and all the weird idiosyncrasies of nature, for me, that connectivity, that's love. Now, within our social systems, within our families, within our work systems, within our teams, what can we do to start to reduce the separation that we have created by being? And I don't see anything wrong with that. Nobody's doing anything wrong. Nobody's doing anything right. This is just part of the identity construction. Now, there's a lot of different types of living out there, and there's a lot of different types of societies. And certain social structures are more geared towards this connectivity. I'm not a particularly religious person, but within the congregations of, say, church or a mosque for Islam or any sort of organizational structure that is bent towards this spiritualist idea, no matter what their main message is, the idea of camaraderie, the idea of being able to be in this group of like-minded individuals, I find that very prescient. So that's kind of what I would like to highlight this week when it comes to this idea of love, is what communities are you part of? What times in your week do you sacrifice your selfishness to go help your family or whatever team that you might be interacting with? While you're doing that interaction, perhaps consider where that I is, where that sense of self is. And when you're working with a team, do you see that sense of self start to dissipate? Does it start to swimmer away? So those are the two legs that I stand on. It's creative living and unconditional love. And every week I will continue to hearken back to these two systems, and I will continue to try to enunciate poorly what it is that my purpose is here on my show. So this week, my main idea that I would like to discuss is pain and attention. I've been living with pain for a little over a year now, and it came on with the losing of my Medicaid and my insurance. So part of this whole process has been bound up in anxiety because of my inability to go get information and to have questions answered and to go have doctors look at me and yada yada. And so when I decided not to find an insurance program, when my social insurance gave out, one of the big points that made my decision was the fact that I didn't think that I'd be going to the doctor enough to make a monthly premium worth it, say $160 a month, or trying to get through all the blah, 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 bureaucratical bullshit. So I decided not to go with insurance because I was making the gamble that I was young enough and healthy enough that I wouldn't have to go. And within about a month or two of that decision is when my ankle first started getting hurt, and it has slowly developed over time and gotten worse, and I've had to learn how to live with the uncomfortability. And recently it's been making it hard for me to sleep because I can't get comfortable at night, and no matter what position I lay in, my ankle will hurt and it'll wake me up. And you know, there's millions, if not billions, of people on this planet who are living with some form of pain. And I was able to persuade myself that this could be a position of pride too. Like I'd finally earned my spot with all the other people who are hurting. And then now that I have a real pain, it kind of made me feel valid as a human, you know? Because a lot of the times in my youth, I felt lucky that I didn't have as many problems. And then now the problems make it seem like the struggle is the catalyst for why life is as vibrant as it is. It's made me respect the things that I do have. It's made me respect the things that I do enjoy. It's made me not take for granted the small happinesses that I do have. Whereas if you're not uncomfortable, you start to take things for granted. So learning how to live with pain is an interesting concept, and I've been working with a lot of different plants to try to like soothe myself and to be able to have some comfort when it gets bad. And a lot of the plants that I've been finding to be effective are usually poppy derivatives, like California poppy has californidine and a schultzine, but it doesn't have any morphine alkaloids. And so it's not a traditional opiate and it doesn't mess with the opiate receptors, but it does have some relief when it comes to the pain. And then Blue Lotus has apomorphine, which is similar to these alkaloids that you can find in poppy. And then Cordialis is another relative of the poppy that has glaucine and a lot of other different alkaloids that have some pain relief. And so finding some of these allies that I can have in my life that can bring comfort gives me some sense of control, you know? And then there's always a position, I'm sure, with pain where it gets to an uncontrollable point where you just have to deal. And that's another lesson that comes in with maturity. But how does attention affect how we perceive pain? And this is something I've been thinking a lot about in the last couple weeks. I had a very strong experience with Amanita pantherina at the beginning of the week that helped elucidate some of my thoughts on this topic. But I happen to have a degree of health anxiety, you know, or hypochondria that I'm certain has some sort of familial genetic background because my mother was severely hypochondriacal. I don't know if that's how you say the word, but she was consistently self-diagnosing herself and finding reasons to medicate. And there was always something wrong, which is kind of what hypochondria is. And that's kind of how my anxiety works because I noticed probably in my early 20s when I first started getting sorenesses from work in my joints and my shoulders. And like sometimes I'd lean over wrong and I'd pull a muscle in my back and then I'd have a kink in my back for about a week. And it would bother me so much just not being in a normal state of normalcy. Like the body has like a resting point that its expectations are normal. And when your body's feeling normal, you don't notice it. If your foot or your ankle or whatever is hurting is working well, you don't notice it. You don't think about it. And so when something doesn't start working well, that's when you start focusing on the little tick. And what I happen to do is my mind will circle back to that problem over and over and over again in a cyclical way, but it'll be all day long. And so I won't be able to think because 90% of my thought process is on this dysfunction. And when I was younger, I'd get colds, and I remember just being just completely incorrigible from a basic cold because just not being able to swallow would annoy me so much that I couldn't do anything. I couldn't focus on my books. I couldn't watch TV because I was obsessing over this dysfunction. Now that I have a full-time problem in my life that hurts, and like walking is a chore now. And learning how to live with it when it's a chronic systemic thing that's not going to go away, like with a cold, you can wait a couple of days and it usually goes away. And you can have that sort of confidence and that sort of degree of security, you know. But part of the mind trip that I've had to learn over this last year is that it's not getting better. It's not going away. If anything, it's getting worse. And so how do you move forward with that? Over time, I've noticed that I don't spend as much time focusing on my pain. I've gotten better at not obsessing with it. I've trained my attention. I've learned how to focus and pour that tension and that stress into a better place. And I found that when I'm the most comfortable is when I'm active. In the morning, when I wake up, when I'm gathering my mind, that's when I always do this sort of scan and I'm looking for all the things that irk and that don't work right. And that's usually when the pain is at its peak, is in the morning and then at night. But during the middle of the day, when I'm moving and I'm active and I'm working, I usually feel great because I have a lot of other things to focus on and my attention has a lot of other things to work on. This has been very potent to me. Like, as a painkiller that doesn't have a chemical base, attention is a powerful tool. Now, this makes me think about when I was a kid and I would complain about anything, you know, like, oh, my hand hurts. And then my dad would say, oh, you want me to kick you in the shin? I'll make you feel better. Because then you move your attention. You're not thinking about your hand anymore. So learning how to notice when something is becoming cyclical, when something is becoming obsessive, learning all of our little ticks, whatever's going to set us off, right? Being able to redefine what it is we're focusing on can have a real effect on our comfortability levels and how we feel, especially if we're living with pain. That's important. So the experience that really got me thinking about this was at the beginning of the week. I've been working on getting into my dreams more, and Sunday night going into Monday morning, I had a very wakeful situation before I got up. And I had a lot of dreams that were very pressing and that moved me and disturbed me. And part of the reason why I found them so disturbing was the degree of commitment that I had in this dream world. I had no sense of there being any reality outside the dream, and I was completely awake in it. And so going into Monday, it kind of fucked me up because I had to figure out what reality was for a while. And so getting home, I was kind of still in this weird tense state. And so I decided poorly to cook up the mushrooms that I just received in the mail. I ordered about 50 grams of Amanita pantherina, where pantherinas are a species of Amanita, but they're notoriously far stronger. Some of the stuff I've read says as much as 10 times stronger. But usually with most of the products that I've found, especially when I don't make my own tea, the potency is not what I expect. And so I don't usually multiply by 10 when I'm making my calculations on potency. I usually use like a 4 factor. But I'm well aware that it has the potential to be far stronger than what I consider it to be. But I was sort of tense and stressed, and I was looking for comfort. And so I went to the substance knowing that it could make me feel good, but not respecting it as a potent teacher and not realizing how strong the dose was in the first place. So usually when I make some tea, I go really slow, especially when I'm first trying it, just so I can register how strong it is. I didn't do that. I just slammed back about 100 milliliters, which is about 4 grams of cooked pantherina, which on the low end, that could be 16 grams of Amanita muscaria, which is a strong dose on the low end. But on the high end, it could be as much as 40 to 50 grams, which is a stupendous dose. but I wasn't thinking very clearly in the moment. So I slammed it back and felt it come on really strongly. And the first 2 hours were mild and gentle. And I had like this cackling laugh. And I was so happy. It was really nice at first, especially. And then I made my sleepy time tea, which was a chaga base and a little bit of lion's mane extract. And I got a tincture for Calia Zacatechi, which is a notorious dream herb from Mexico, which I've been playing around and working with for the last couple weeks. The last extract I had was nowhere near as strong as this tincture, though. And I wasn't thinking clearly. And so I put the dropper in there and started drinking my tea, and I drank it. And within about 5 minutes of finishing the tea, I started to notice a disassociation. And I'm not convinced as to where this physical attribute of the experience came from, but I started to have a hard time feeling my teeth because I've been impacted molar, and I haven't been able to go to the doctor, so I've been anxious and obsessing. And almost all the time, my tongue throughout the day is finding a tooth that has some issue and then checking it out to the point that I'll like rub my tongue raw. And so I'm used to doing this thing. And all of a sudden I notice that I can't do it anymore because the ability for my tongue to know which teeth it's touching is starting to slow down. And it was almost like a numbing sensation, but not like Novocaine. It almost felt like my sense of who I was starting to become separated from my body so that I couldn't exactly feel what was going on. And like, so the inside of my mouth was becoming unfeelable. And then my body was also becoming unfeelable. And it was almost a numbing sensation. It was very bizarre. And it could have been an interaction between the calia, but it also could have just been because of such an enormous dose of muscimol. Anyways, I started to get a little scared at this point, and my typical strategy with sedatives when I overdo it, like even when I was drinking alcohol, if I drank too much, my main strategy was just to go to bed. So I turned the TV off. I'm like, all right, this is a little too strong. I'm going to go lay down and try to go to bed. So I get in bed, I lay down, I close my eyes, and it feels like I wake up, but I never went to sleep. That makes any sense. It was the most bizarre sensation. It was like there was two of me, because I would be in this sleep state where I'd be leaving this reality, but then at the same time I was thoroughly awake in this reality. And it was very disorientating and very weird, and I couldn't get to bed. Like, it's like I would keep trying to go to sleep, and I would convince myself I was asleep and that I wouldn't be. And that kept going on for about an hour. And during this time, my mind is bent in a way that it has never been bent before. And even though I was slightly worried that I'd hurt myself or gotten close to some sort of overdose or something, I also had this sense of calm, and I had this conviction that I knew I was going to be okay. And so as soon as I was able to put the fear down a little bit, I became very excited because I'd never experienced anything like this in my life. Like, I'm explaining this poorly. I've been trying to figure out how to explain this for the last couple of days, but it doesn't really matter. Whilst in this state, I had this weird ability to watch my thoughts grow. And the thought of, am I awake? Am I asleep? I would watch it spawn as like, and it almost had this like, this physical image in my head, but it wasn't like a classical hallucination, like a visualization for any tryptamine or any other hallucinogenic substance. But it's like I had this motif in my head of the idea being born, am I awake or am I asleep? And I could watch it split into two different things, the awake and the asleep, like the quantum, you know, up and down, 0-1, like quantum mechanical computing kind of bullshit. And then those two dots would think again, and I would see it split into awake and asleep. And it's like it grew. And then it would start over again because I would notice the thought growing, and then I would start the system again. And it was so fucking weird. And I know this is kind of hard to understand, but that's kind of where I built a lot of this thinking about attention this week is because it really gave me this sense of noticing how I was creating the idea and the thought in the first place. And that's happening right now, but it's happening subconsciously. And a lot of the times we distract ourselves into a very compelling narrative and the storytelling of what's happening in that essential negation. And we don't see where the seeds are coming from. We don't see where the sprouts are growing out of. We don't see where a lot of these feelings began. We just see the reaction and we see where we end up. We see the feelings about whatever it is. But before whatever it is was there, was the beginning of a thought, was the beginning of a seed that helped make this whole moment happen. And that relates intimately to pain. It relates intimately to how we perceive our lives and how we make our own comfort. So I was in this weird in and out dream space for like, it was probably about an hour. And I tried to pay attention and then I lost consciousness because I was kind of trying because I was scared. And so in order to run away from this fearsome, harrowing experience, I delved headfirst into unconsciousness. And I slept deeply, and I don't remember a lot of dreams because the sleep was so deep. One of the things I've noticed about myself is that if I'm going to have a lot of dreams, the sleep is never deep. It's sort of a restless sleep, a wakeful sleep. That's when I have more lucid dreaming. And so I woke up at 6, I had to go to work. And when I woke up, I felt so amazing. And that's one of the things I found with Amanitas that is one of their most functional, beneficial, medicinal parts is the glow on the next day, especially after a big dose. It's just absolutely phenomenal. I learned so much from the experience, and I hope that there's something in that story that's relatable. I hope it can help you understand why I wanted to talk about pain and attention today. And if anything, I hope that it helps. I hope that in some way I could help you find a way to be more comfortable. So yeah, if you'd like to speak about any of this or have a talk or a conversation or an argument, if you have any disagreements with me, please reach out to the email address, which is thegingerbreadmansdialogues@gmail.com. It's also in the show notes because I know it's kind of lengthy. But please reach out. We can talk about anything. And if you have something really compelling, I'll even put it on the show. So don't forget, you're not alone, that you're surrounded by everybody else too, and that we're all in it together. And I'm here for you too. So I'm going to go find a book, and we'll see if Odin wants to say anything. He just started his first day of school today. He's very excited, and he did a really good job, and maybe he'll share with you. So I'll be right back. All right, this week I'm reading from Zen Driving by K.T. Berger, and that's not one person. It's actually two people. I think it's two brothers. K is one person, T is another. I'll look for it. What's their names? Yeah. Anyways, but this book's called Zen Driving, and it's basically looking at this principle from Zen called moving meditation. So in the monasteries, they would have, sitting meditations for an extended amount of time, learning how to focus, learning how to foster attention. But in between these sitting meditations, which is what most people think is sitting on a towel or on the floor in cross-legged lotus position. But they would also intermix these moving meditations where they'd go walk around the campus and the focus was on each step and on each breath and on what's happening around us. And so this book is really cool because it takes this old idea of moving meditation and it applies it to driving, which is something that so many adults have to do, especially in the Western world. And how using this part of our day, which for me is a pretty large part of my day. I spend almost an hour and a half in my car every day driving to and from work and, chauffeuring to therapies and whatnot. But it's an opportunity to practice focus and mindful awareness, which is what meditation is. So here goes. Natural self versus external control. Assertion is a natural form of awareness. Unfortunately, awareness is more often maintained by worrying whether or not a cop is in the vicinity. Rather than relying on the awareness and assertion of natural self to dictate our actions, we often look elsewhere. It's an illusion that the harmony of our roads is maintained by external forces or factors such as road signs, lights, lines, and laws. We come to rely on these external controls, and when something out of the ordinary comes upon us, a broken light, an erratic driver, we frequently become disorientated. Professional driving studies differentiate between what they call drivers who have an external locus of control and those with an internal locus of control. The studies conclude that the latter, who act more independently, are quicker to pick up distinct items embedded in their immediate environment. In other words, their perceptions are sharper, and statistically are better and safer drivers. The truth is, harmony always begins with the individual, the integrated, undivided individual who, Fritz Perls, knows that the only control is the situation. This really is the only law. It is the thinking behind the best in road engineering. Again, it's a popular misconception that things such as traffic lights are safety devices positioned to issue hardened orders to drivers. Actually, road engineers regard these devices chiefly as instruments in the production of orderly movement. It's a favorite joke in New York City that traffic laws are only guidelines. But that's actually the truth. Everywhere. Streets and roads are designed to aid the flow of traffic with safety as a hoped-for byproduct. The final responsibility always rests with the individual. William Garrison, head of the Department of Transportation at UC Berkeley, nicely stresses this point. Suppose everybody drove according to the law, he told me, that they came to full stops at every single stop sign, that they followed one another at 2-second intervals. Traffic would not work. There would be congestion everywhere. Though the roads are rule-bound systems, there's a collective understanding of how things really work. So, I think that kind of applies to some of the ideas that I put in today. But anyway, maybe just consider where your direction's coming from. Thank you so much for being with me today. Can't wait to get back to you next week. Take care.
People, this is the Asko and the Gingerbread Man.
Woo!
I'm back.
Baby.
Stop. was I here the last time?
Nope.
Yeah, sorry I wasn't here last time. Stress, I wasn't feeling it. But
it's okay.
I'm back.
That's cool. What'd you do today?
Well, I went to my school.
Was it your first day?
Yep.
It was a new school too, huh?
Yep.
How'd you feel about it?
Good.
Did you like it?
Yeah. I hope parents out there have kids have a good hope their kids have a good time.
Me too.
At school.
Me too. Makes it feel better, huh?
Yeah.
I'm really happy you had a good time. That makes my day.
Yeah.
All right. Got any advice to give anybody? You ready to go?
Yeah.
Okay.
Advice to be, well, if you're not feeling good, make a fortune teller.
Oh.
And that would be great.
Like your therapist did?
Yes.
Cool. All right, guys. We'll talk to you next week. Bye.
Bye.